And we are back, and we are momentarily joined by my guest, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney on the House Judiciary Committee, who now hosts his radio show, The Inside Scoop from Washington, and Mike Lane, a Republican strategist who was a key player opposing the Clinton-era healthcare reform. He is president of Intellifant Strategies. He will probably correct my pronunciation of it, advising Republicans on domestic, foreign policy, and election strategies. Good afternoon, Mike.
Sasha, thank you for having me, and you pronounced it exactly right, strategies.
Oh, great. I mean, has it got to do with something to do with elephant as in Republican strategy?
It is an intelligent elephant, which I'm sure Mark Levine will tell you is an oxymoron, but we'll let him speak for himself.
Well, anyway, I'm happy that I made a correct guest here. Now, let me say that I have invited these gentlemen for an informal debate. Basically, it's on the subject of the debate of the healthcare reform. So how it is being conducted and what have you learned from it so far? And I'm going to ask basically one fundamental question, and I ask both of you to respond, and then we can take it from there. The question is, as some people try to come to an understanding, is health insurance, meaning basically it's a means to survival, like water, is it part of a human rights, or is health insurance a commodity to be traded for profit? And Mike Lane, go ahead.
Well, Sasha, I think it's both, and there are a lot of nuances here, but let me briefly say, ultimately, everyone is entitled to health care, but I don't think that the whole world is entitled to health care at your expense and my expense and the expense of your listeners. Where we are is a situation where I believe health care is not only a right, but it's a responsibility. With rights go responsibilities, and it is each individual person's responsibility to ensure that, number one, they take care of themselves, and number two, they prepare for those circumstances where they may need health care above and beyond what would be considered routine. Way too many people do not do that. There are other avenues, I think, other than the government as the first resort to do that. There are obviously employer-provided health programs. There are community-provided health programs. There are going to the emergency room, which is not a particularly efficient method, but guarantees everyone in America health care as a last resort by going that route, and that ultimately we should have a social safety net in this country, and that social safety net should include health care for those people who truly need it. I do not believe, however, as I think President Obama believes and the Democratic Party believes, that the government should be the first stop for health care instead of the last stop.
Okay, Mark, does the president believe that government is the first stop?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, President Obama has made it clear from the beginning that he doesn't support something that actually I support, which is single payer. He believes that there should be a public option, and an option is just that, an option. People can go to the government or they can go to private health insurance. And when Mike Lane says that the government shouldn't be a first resort, he knows that the emergency rooms that he talks about that cover everyone are the first resort for many, indeed probably most, uninsured people. So when they go to the emergency room because they have a major heart problem and need a quintuple heart bypass surgery, that's extremely expensive. It might cost $100,000, and all taxpayers have to pay for it. Whereas with a public option, you could give that person the kind of preventative care that Mike Lane says he needs. People need responsibility for their health care, so they pay, I don't know, $100 a month for heart medicine, and they never get that heart problem that requires them to pay at public expense. So it seems to me it's not only a moral imperative to cover everyone, but it's actually cheaper for taxpayers to cover everyone because emergency care is so much more expensive than preventative care.
All right. Mike, what is your feeling? How would you describe the current uninsured public? Do you have any profile for them? Because it sounds like we are, shall we say, we are blaming them for not being fit and not being insurable.
Well, Sasha, you know, there are a number of estimates out there. I don't think anyone knows. I think the most commonly quoted figure for uninsured in America is about 48 million people. And the estimates I've seen on that are that you have maybe a quarter of that, maybe 12 million people who are between jobs and about to get health insurance through their new job. Of course, that figure might be a little bit higher in today's economy. About 25% of that would be young people who are healthy and mistakenly think that they're going to live forever and choose as a lifestyle not to spend their money on health coverage. The third would be people who are, for one reason or another, not eligible for health coverage. They are folks who perhaps can't get a job that provides health coverage because they're in this country illegally and they don't have the ability to get a job that would have those kinds of benefits. And then the fourth category, which covers roughly 25% of it again, would be called other. And those are people in every other category that you can imagine.
Any comment, Mark?
Yes, I think the one group that Mike didn't mention is those that are uninsurable through no fault of their own because they have some pre-existing condition that the insurance companies won't insure. The dirty little secret about health insurance in America is that their goal, the insurance company's goal, is to insure healthy people. And when you get sick, to drop you from the rolls as fast and as quickly as they legally can. Their goal is only to insure the people that don't need the coverage. And I would say that's a perverse system that leads to a lot of profits for the insurance companies, but doesn't help people who, through no fault of their own, have some genetic condition and need health care in America.
Well, it's like...
Well, Mark, Sasha, if I may, you know, I think Mark exaggerates that a little bit. You probably are going to have difficulty getting coverage. If you have a very serious pre-existing condition, you're probably going to have trouble as an individual going out there in the open market and trying to procure health coverage for yourself that will cover that. On the other hand, when you get a new job with an employer who provides a group policy for the employees of that company, 99% of the time those policies are written so that there is no discussion of pre-existing conditions. There is a certain amount of time for people to come in after they become employees of that company and enroll in that coverage, and pre-existing conditions are never covered in that thing. So it's not that nobody can get coverage for a pre-existing condition. It's simply that individuals pursuing a policy can't get it. And I think Mark and I would both agree, as Republicans and Democrats nationally agree, that we do need some insurance reforms that covers the pre-existing condition situation, which is very, very serious. What we don't need is a wholesale takeover of the private health care sector by the United States government.
Okay, Mark. Mike referred to the people who can get a job and get insured. But from what I hear, is the small businesses who create most jobs. Do small businesses are in the business of insuring their employees?
Well, some do and some don't. There is no requirement under a certain amount. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think we have to ask ourselves, should our health care be tied to our job? I have a good friend of mine, in fact, who she has a hip condition that was genetic, and she was in pain for 3 years because she had to switch jobs in order to get the job that would give her the health care she needed. And then she had to stay in that job for a full year in order for the benefits to accrue. And she did all of these major lifestyle changes in her life simply to get the health care. Should people be changing jobs and seeking jobs just to get health care, or should they be looking at jobs based on things like whether they like the job, whether it pays enough, whether it's good for their families? I would like to decouple the employee-based system from health care. Now, I realize Obama's plan doesn't go that far, but one of the things a public option would do would allow those who don't want their health care tied to their job to be able to have a portable system.
If access to health care is essential for one's survival, do we agree to that? Mark?
Certainly. I mean, not all health care. I mean, there certainly is cosmetic surgery and other things.
No. I mean, basically...
There certainly is some health care that, of course, is necessary to live.
So then should private insurance be regulated like a utility company to ensure service at a rate affordable to the general public?
At the very least, I would argue. Mike?
Well, private insurance is regulated heavily by the states. There are, you cannot offer a health coverage plan in the United States of America, in any one of our 50 states, without going through the state insurance commission, without telling them exactly what it is you're offering. State legislatures weigh in on a daily basis, legislating what needs to be covered and what doesn't need to be covered. I mean, we all know there are a great many states that require, you know, Mark was just about to toss overboard cosmetic surgery, but there are any number of states that require cosmetic surgery to be covered. There are any number of states that require Viagra to be covered. You know, these are things that drive up artificially the cost of health care.
All right, but how is it then that people end up being canceled if they happen to develop an illness that the insurance company doesn't like?
Well, let me go first, Mark. I'm not sure, Sasha, where what your question is, but let me offer an observation. If there are any circumstances where you develop an illness that the insurance company doesn't like, they should not have a legal right to cancel you just because they don't like your illness. Now, plans are written, you know, people buy coverage in an attempt to be realistic about it. People buy coverage that they think they or their employees are going to need. And there is virtually no such thing as an unlimited policy. I mean, you can be in a situation where you might exceed the limits of a policy in a particular area or something like that. Those certainly need to be looked at and updated, because if you have a policy that limits you to an unrealistically low lifetime benefit, I don't think that that's really the kind of coverage that that we're looking for. But I don't know of anybody who has just been canceled because, let's say, they got whooping cough or cancer or something else, and the insurance company said, you know what, we don't like that cancer, we're gonna end this policy.
You know, I'm reminded of when President Barack Obama's mother died at a fairly young age. She was too young to afford Medicare. She was in her 50s. And as she was dying, she had to worry about getting coverage and fighting health care insurance and paying bills. You know, the question is, do we want an America like that? I mean, in Australia, in Japan, in virtually every European country, they don't have to do that. You simply show a card, you show up to the doctor, and the interesting thing is their costs are less than half our costs, and the people in all those countries live longer. So they're doing something right. And I think that by allowing a public option, it forces the insurance companies, which after all make 30% of their profits. I mean, 30% of all health care goes to administrative costs, goes to insurance companies and filling out forms and all those things that wouldn't be necessary in a Medicare-like program. And the fascinating thing is all the Republican arguments could be used to argue that we shouldn't have Medicare anymore. But Republicans know that people actually like Medicare, that people in Medicare like it, and so they're trying to bring up all these other alternative arguments, things like, you know, death care and red herrings like that, because they don't want to admit the basic truth, which is most Americans like Medicare. They do well in it. If you want supplemental insurance, you get that too, that this mixture of public and private does work.
Well, Mark, right. I love it when you leave me an opening like this, and thank you so much for doing that. The fact of the matter is, the simple fact of the matter is that the government-run programs, both Medicare and Medicaid, have two things wrong with them. Number one, they're both going broke. I mean, they literally cannot sustain themselves for the immediate future, much less the mid-range or the long-range future, without massive increases in taxes and infusion of new public monies to make them work. So to hold them out as some sort of efficient example is actually, you know, not a good example. And the second thing is, we all know that the facts are out there, the statistics are out there. Medicare reimburses the health care system at a rate of 94 cents on the dollar, which means that any provider of medical services for a Medicare patient gets reimbursed for only 94% of their expenses. The rest of the money comes from the private sector, and it's even worse for Medicaid. They reimburse at a rate of only 86%, 86 cents on the dollar, and the rest of the money comes from the ability of the Medicare of the medical system to overcharge the insurance companies and private patients at a rate of $1.31 per hundred to cover the losses they get from the government programs.
All right, let me, Mark, just a minute.
Go ahead,
in the earlier guest with Roger Hickey, it came up that we were talking about the fact that what if the age limit were reduced or lowered for Medicare, and younger generation of people who may have less health problems can join Medicare and pay into the system, and it may help to sustain Medicare.
I happen to think that's a terrific solution. Younger people obviously don't have the health care problems that more elderly people do, and they can afford to pay in the system and make it more sustainable. The people in Medicare, the people over 65, the people that use Medicare in the United States are very, very supportive of it. You don't hear too many complaints about it. And the fiscal problems that Mike raises certainly could be fixed by expanding it to allow younger, more healthy people to join the system. I was shocked when I learned that a lot of what people pay into Medicare is less than what I pay for health insurance. And Medicare has kept costs down. If you look at every single year since 1970, the cost of Medicare has gone up about two-thirds what the cost of private insurance has gone up. And that's because that one-third is profits for a for-profit industry. Medicare does keep costs down, and I agree. Expanding it to younger people would improve the fiscal sustainability of the system.
All right. Let us go to the telephone because people are lining up to talk to you, and we are going first to Lou in Fort Myers. Lou, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Sasha, and thanks for your show. I have a comment, a question for your guests, my answer, and I'd like their response.
Oh, wow.
Okay, here's the comment. Many Americans are deeply uncomfortable when thinking or talking about death. And that is why the phrase death panels is so effective, even though it's not true. My question, how do we get fearful Americans to get past their fear and use their good reason to support health care reform, which is in their very own interest? I believe the only answer is to speak truth to untruth.
All right.
Let me respond to Lou.
Thank you for your call, Lou. Please listen to the radio for the response. Okay.
I do appreciate Lou's call. I think this whole death panel nonsense is something that is done specifically by Republicans to raise up fear over Americans and make everyone scared of health care insurance reform. What this provision is, by the way, and it's only in some of the bills, it's not in other the bills, is that if a patient requests end-of-life counseling, it's a very difficult question when people decide whether or not to, you know, if they want to stay in a coma, for example, for months on end, or whether they want the doctor to pull the plug. If they request end-of-life counseling, some of the bills, and not others of the bills, would allow government-funded therapists to help people with end-of-life counseling.
So in other words, I have a living will for which I paid handsomely, and if you wish, you can get that from Medicare.
Exactly. This is not there's no death panel. There's no group of doctors saying you live, you die. If people want this kind of counseling, some of the bills allow it. If the patient wants it. That's all it is. And truly, it's a red herring. I mean, it's a tail wagging the dog. There are much bigger questions here, and I think they're using that solely as a scare tactic.
Mike, do you think this was Frank Luntz's idea, like he changed the estate tax to death tax? Mike?
Say that one more time, Sasha, please.
I said, do you think this was Frank Luntz's idea, who changed the estate tax to death tax?
Well, obviously you use words that resonate with the electorate when you're trying to get your point across, and I think both sides would do that.
I expected you to giggle at that. Okay.
Well, okay, I'm giggling.
All right.
Mike's a political strategist. He knows that fear works.
let me answer Mark's point and Lou's point in Fort Myers. And Lou, I love Fort Myers. I spent a lot of time there. But my mother's 85 years old, and 20 years ago, or actually 25 years ago, when my mother was, I think, 61, 24 years ago, and my father was 65, they sat down with me and my brothers and my sisters, and we had a discussion about what their expectations would be at the end of life. And it was a family thing. It wasn't a government bureaucracy thing. And we talked about what they wanted, and they both wrote living wills, and they both signed do not resuscitate orders. And they're both still in place. Now, my father passed away a couple years ago, and the fact that he had a DNR or a do not resuscitate order played a part in his end-of-life care. But that was a decision that was come to by my parents and by their family, their children sitting there. And it wasn't something that the government involved itself in. It wasn't legislated, and Mark cites that it's voluntary. Well, it's not voluntary in the House version. If you look at what Congressman Waxman of California wrote, he was mandating end-of-life counseling with a government bureaucrat every 5 years.
Let me ask you, do you believe that it has a sort of an underlying purpose of actually trying to, shall we say, mandate activity for these people or suggest a, suggest a choice for them?
I do, Sasha. Unfortunately, I do. Look, my mother's 85 now. I don't see any reason. I talk to my mother as a son to my mother every couple of months about this to make sure she's still on board, and she is. And I'm the person in my family who's vested with the responsibility of making these decisions per her living will. And I'm comfortable with that, and she's comfortable with that. Why does Congressman Waxman want to scare my 85-year-old mother by mandating every 5 years she have a consultation with a government bureaucrat whose real function in life, let's face it, is to ensure that we don't go over budget in our global medical budget for the country?
Okay, Mark, is it a mandate?
Absolutely
or,
not.
Or if
in the House bill
or
it was
wait a minute, if Mike's mother has already made arrangements.
First of all, this is entirely voluntary, and I'm going to quote the bill. I'm going to give you chapter and verse so you know that what Mike's saying just simply isn't true. Section 1233 of America's Affordable Health Choices Act of 2009, go to page 425, which was the page cited by the conservatives, and you can see that it is entirely voluntary. If a patient requests to know things like living wills, things like discussing orders for life-sustaining treatment, then you go to the Ways and Means House.gov. You can go to their website, check it out. You can also go to PolitiFact.com. It's simply not true. It is optional. If people want it, it is provided. And some, by the way, some versions of the health care bill, and there is no single bill yet, don't provide it at all. But the ones that do provide it as an option. And I would cite PolitiFact.com and the Ways and Means .house.
And if you already have an arrangement, would it be, shall we say, repeated or requested?
No. Look, I think it's beautiful what Mike did with his parents. I think it's something that I advocate everyone to do, to talk with their families to do it. But some people don't know what the options are. Some people need to have the living will explained to them. They don't understand the difference between a do not resuscitate order and an order about breathing tubes, and they want to be explained what their options are so they can give an intelligent response to such an important decision.
All right, let me stop you because we have two people waiting and we are running out of time, and I ask people to phrase their question quickly. First, we are going to Chuck and then to Gina. Chuck, go ahead, please. Good afternoon, Chuck. I guess Chuck gave up. We are going next to Gina. Gina, go ahead, please.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I think we already spend more money on healthcare than anywhere else in the world, and yet we rank 37th. I think all this talk of money is ridiculous. It needs to be managed better. The whole management system is wrong. Health insurance and healthcare in general is primarily interested in profit, not in getting people well. And quite honestly, I come away from these discussions feeling that the Republicans really don't care about how well we provide health care for our U.S. citizens, but more interested in having Obama fail. Just as this gentleman just said, mandate instead of offered or optional. That's very, very different.
All right, Gina, thank you for your call. Thanks for
calling.
Thank you. All right. We are wrapping up, and this is the kind of discussion where we have. We could do it for a whole day. So, last parting word, Mark?
Simply to say that it is an option and that basically Medicare, people are happy with it. And if you don't want the public option, you can continue with your private health insurance. It's not the major care that Republicans are making it.
And Mike, very quickly, please.
Sasha, we have the best health care system in the world by far. The president just compared the government option to the post office. I will leave it with the standard form. If you like the post office, you will love government-run health care.
Well, I understand that you were an advocate against the previous health care bill, and I know why. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sasha. I like the post office.
We have come to the end of the program today. I thank my guests, Roger Hickey, Mark Levine, and Mike Lane. My producers were Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. Please tune in next Friday at noon for another timely conversation. And remember, you can hear the program live or archived on the internet at wgcu.org/Sasha. You can write me at sashashow@comcast.net. And if you wish to add a question or comment about the program, you can call our 24/7 feedback line 877-GCU-TALK and record your thoughts on the voicemail. And now, please stay tuned for BBC's World Have Your Say coming up next. Thank you for listening, and have a safe and wonderful weekend.